all of them, and one of them in particular, she's like, "Mommy, mommy, mommy, is Abba gonna die? Is Abba gonna die?" And I'm like, "No, why would Abba die?" She's like, "Mommy, is Abba gonna die?" And I'm like, "No, why would he die? We were talking to him. He's just as alive as me and you. Like, we were all in the car. Like, but he didn't come out." I said, "Okay, he was stuck in the car. The paramedics are gonna come. They're gonna take him out. Like, it'll be okay." And she didn't believe me. She was probably right to believe me, but I wasn't lying to her at that point. And along this whole thing, like, we had said we were going to be very open with the kids. Like, the kids always knew, like, if my husband was sick, how sick it was and how serious it was, so that they knew that they could trust us. They knew if I said not to worry, they knew not to worry. Like, even, I mean, over the course of this whole journey, like, I sent kids to Eretz Yisrael and to seminary, and they were, like, you know, miles and miles away from home, but they knew that if I was in the hospital, but it's okay. They're like, okay. You know, like, so they trusted that we were telling them the truth. So I told them the truth as I knew it at that point. So they went back out. And then a few minutes later, like, I'm asking the nurses again, "So tell me what's going on, any news?" She goes, "Yes, we now have some news." I said, "So what's going on?" They said, "Well, he has a spinal cord injury." And I'm trying to think quickly, like, spinal cord injury, that doesn't sound very good. I don't know very much about spinal cord injury, but I do know that people with spinal cord injuries can't walk, can they? So I say, "Can he walk?" And she looks at me and she goes, no, he won't be able to walk. And at that point, I took the deepest breath that I possibly could. And I had to make a major, major decision. I had to decide, okay, am I going to crumble and scream and hide my head under the pillow right now? Or am I going to figure this out? And honestly, screaming, yelling, and hiding my head under the pillow seemed like a really, really good option at that point. Because all I thought about, spinal cord injury, not walking, all I knew was that when a person can't walk, they sit in a wheelchair and somebody wheels them around, or they get this really cute gadget that they can drive themselves. But I did not know at that point that when a person is paralyzed, they're not just being pushed around in a cute little gadget. Their health is at stake. My husband was a cholesh, a yeshvo sakana for the rest of his life. So I did not know that yet. I think that it was a good thing that I didn't realize what it encompassed, because that was big enough, like, to know that my husband would never, ever walk again. What I did not know at that point was that not only would he never walk again, but he was a quadriplegic. A quadriplegic, quad is the number 4. So that means all 4 of his limbs were affected, 2 arms, 2 legs. He was paralyzed from the chest down. So couldn't move. He was stuck. So when he said in the car, "I can't move," and I thought he meant because the car is crushed, he couldn't move. And at that point, I took a deep breath and I said to myself, "Shingle, you have kids on the other side of that curtain. And those kids are counting on you, and those kids need you. You cannot crumble now. You don't have that luxury." And I took a deep breath, and at that point I said, "Okay, we're gonna get through this. We're going to figure this out. I don't know how. I have no idea how. I don't know what this means, but crumbling is not an option." And at that point, or, you know, sometime later, like, as it became, it was almost morning by that point, I found out that they were helicoptering my husband from the scene of the accident to Syracuse, New York, which has a trauma center, which is an hour south of Watertown. And they hadn't done really anything to me because they were waiting to see what was happening with my husband, to see where he would be going so they could take me to be in the same hospital as him. So I got ambulanced down to Syracuse to be hospitalized in what's technically not the same hospital as him, but they were connected, 2 hospitals that were connected through, like, this underpass thing. I was in the hospital for, I think, 10 days. And my husband was in the ICU for 3 weeks before we were airlifted back home to Ottawa. And he was in the ICU for a total of 3 months. And then he was in rehab center. He was an inpatient in the rehab center for another 6 months. And as you can imagine, or as if you can't, things were very, very trying. Things were very, very complicated. And just, we didn't realize just how ill, like I just didn't realize, like how dangerously sick he really, really was and how everything was really, really so precarious for those first few weeks. And that was why he was in Syracuse for that length of time until he was deemed stable enough to be able to be transferred back home. And we had a whole lot of adjusting to do to our new reality because we lived on one side of town. The rehab center was on the other side of town. I was home with my kids. My kids stayed by my sister. They lived with my sister for a total of 5 weeks in Rochester. My daughter, who was 2.5 years old at the time, like for like a year after, you would ask her, where do you live? She'd go, Rochester. She didn't live in Rochester anymore, but she thought she lived in Rochester. She spent so much time there. And we had to eventually bring the kids home from Rochester, get into a routine at home, get help in the house, organize me spending most of my days at the hospital, and of course, awaiting the birth of my baby. So we had, like, there was a lot going on. You know, the care of all the kids, the care of my husband, organizing everything. So one of the first things that we did was, I really was very intent on my husband being at the birth of the baby. He had been at the births of all of our other kids, and I wasn't gonna give that up. So I switched hospitals and doctors so that I would be able to deliver in the hospital where he was as a patient in the ICU. And the hospital was amazing. There's a documentary about it online. The hospital was amazing in that the ICU and the LDR, the labor delivery area, coordinated with each other to make it happen. We moved into the hospital. It wasn't until years later that my kids didn't realize that, you mean like in ICU people are sick, they die? Like, yeah, they're like, Abba was in the hospital. We went to Abba every day. We visited him. That's a whole nother story in itself, like when they saw him for the first time. And we lived there. Like, that's where Abba was, that's where we were. If Abba's there, we're there. They didn't, that was our life. And we had my daughter's bas mitzvah in the hospital, and okay, so now we're awaiting the birth of this baby. And the hospital is coordinating the whole bit. And finally, I'm thinking, okay, it's time to have the baby. And, you know, just the short story is that as soon as I realized that something was brewing, I called the hospital and said, I know you need time, just make it happen. Make sure that he is there in time. And I think the nurses were super excited because all the nurses were like, I would come every day, they're like, oh, you're still here? Oh, I want to be on call when you have the baby. I want to go with him to have the baby. I'm like, don't need all of you. Thank you. Stay where you are. You know? But they gave us like this like supersized room because it had to accommodate. My husband was still in like a hospital bed. He came with like breathing machines. He came on a feeding tube. He came with a nurse. He came with a respiratory therapist. He had a whole entourage. You know, there's more of his people than my people in that room, you know? And I mean, it was unbelievable. They got him there just as the baby was being born. Like just, he was in the room as my baby was being born. And when the baby was born, they took the baby and handed the baby to him. And this picture of him holding the baby, like minutes, seconds old, in that delivery room, and we were just bawling. Like, there wasn't a dry eye in the room. Like, everybody was just realizing, just like, what a nace. And this baby, who I had been monitored for, Baruch Hashem, perfect. Nothing, you know, nothing. I mean, he's 9. He is charming. I'm telling you, this boy is going to be spoiled for his entire life. This poor kid, you know, he calls me, like, Mommy, when are you coming home? I miss you. I'm like, oh, you know, he's just going to always be like a mushy boy. But like, there was an article about us in the Mishpacha, like years ago. The article is called Miracle Daddy. You know, there's a picture of him and my husband, you know. And that was like so unbelievable. So I think one of the things that I've seen, like along this journey, is that the highs are so high, and even when the lows are so low, it makes the highs so much more real. Like the birth of a baby was amazing, but just to see, like, just so many, when you take things for granted, you can't take things for granted. And just to realize, like, the things that, you know, are just supposed to be, they're so much deeper, and they're so much more real, you know, like, the simcha, like, because we've gone through so much, the simchas are so much stronger also. I think it just makes you just so much more aware. And originally when I realized that I was expecting, and it was around Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur time, I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to be in the hospital all by myself on like Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. That's so depressing. Okay, I didn't know what depressing meant, you know? But honestly, there was nothing depressing. He was born on Erev Rosh Hashanah. It was perfect timing. It was just so beautiful and so special. He was born Wednesday morning. Rosh Hashanah was Wednesday night. It was a 3-day yontif. And we had arranged for my kids to be with my brother and sister-in-law on the side of town where the hospital was. The hospital gave us a conference room. So we were going to have all the meals. We were going to bring them from the house we were staying in, which was at least a good half hour walk away. We were going to schlep all the meals over to have them, the day meals, to have in the hospital room, in the hospital, in the conference room. My brother-in-law was coming from Chicago. He was going to be there to spend yontif with my brother in the hospital, to be with him for the night meal, so he shouldn't be alone over yontif. And in the end, I was in the hospital too, with the baby. So my brother-in-law, my husband, the nurse, the RT, and the whole entourage came to my room Wednesday night for the first Suda of Rosh Hashanah. And it was just something really, really special. And what made it even more special was that for those 3 months, my husband was being weaned off the respirator. And slowly, slowly, he was increasing the amounts of time that he was able to breathe on his own. He had to relearn how to breathe. And that was the day that, you know, a culminating of all the weeks and weeks of therapy and practicing, that they took out the trach completely. And they said it was, you know, he had graduated. He could breathe on his own. So he always said that my baby and I, we took our first breaths on the same day. And then the next day, the first day of yontif, we went downstairs to the conference room, me in a wheelchair, because I had just had a baby, and they were like wheeling me, you know, throughout the hospital, pushing the baby in his bassinet, and my brother-in-law pushing my husband in his wheelchair. You have to laugh. It's crazy, right? Two parents in a wheelchair. Like, really? So we're going down, and my whole family's down there, and it was the first time that our family had been together. And like, Shabbos yontif, it was so important to us, like all the years. So for us to have, like, it's the whole, we had a yontif suda in the hospital with my husband, with the whole family, with my brother-in-law, brother, sister, rabbi came and blew the shofar for us. We felt like it was Rosh Hashanah. It was a new start. It was a new year. We were going to continue on from here. But as my life is kind of like on the balance, like, so I do things twice, or I do things like up and down, like, so we were all excited about that, and it's Rosh Hashanah, and we're having yontif, but at the same time, my husband was supposed to be leaving the ICU within the next week, and to move into the rehab center, which is, again, connected to the hospital, but through, like, a long corridor, and they wanted us to come see the rehab center, and we went on yontif, being pushed in our wheelchairs, you know, all yontif thick, not, you know, to go check out the rehab center. My husband was discharged from the ICU the night before the baby's bris. And the baby, we had his bris in the rehab center. So our guests came to the rehab center. The rehab center gave us, again, they gave us a conference room, and they were accommodating, and they had never seen anything like this before. And basically, wherever my husband was, that's where home was. The rehab center became our home for the next 6 months. You know, we went, you know, not every night for supper, but we would go sometimes for supper. We had people coming to him for Shabbos. And then it was like right after Sukkot, and my sister-in-law was coming for 2 weeks from Eretz Yisrael. And she was asking me about, like, where should she go for Shabbos? So I said, well, it's kind of fair that you should really spend Shabbos with Yehuda in the rehab center, but that's on the other side of town, and you're only here for 2 weeks, and I really want to have you for myself and for the kids. So, how's about we all go to the rehab center? So we did. We went to the other side of town. We went to the Burger's house, and it was, we left the little kids there. We drove over before Shabbos to the rehab center. We brought everything from soup to nuts, like everything, to the rehab center. And again, they gave us a room, which was called the Blue Room. The Blue Room was some room that they did like training and stuff for the people there. And the Blue Room became the Shabbos room. And we bench lifted in there, and we had, you know, Shabbos. And that's what we did for the next bunch of Shabbosim until he was able to come home for Shabbos. And it's funny, I mean, like, after a couple weeks, we're like, you know, we haven't had challenge in a really long time. Let's ask them if we could, you know, we'll make a power of challenge. We don't have to worry about Basar, you know, let's just leave it. And like, yeah, sure, no problem. We worked it out with them. So like Shabbos morning, we're coming upstairs to the rehab center smelled like challenge. It smelled like Shabbos. You know, it was just, it is. Hanukkah, we had, you know, we lit the menorah. And it was just really, really, really important to my husband and myself that it's a family journey, it's a family process, and the family is going to stay together, and we are going to make this happen. And it's not easy. It sounds like fun, some of this. Some parts were fun. You know, Shabbos afternoon, we're all camping out in the Blue Room. You know, we bring Shabbos party and books and puzzles and, like, you know, you have to laugh. You have to laugh. You have to keep yourself, you know, a sense of humor. But while this is all going on, like, real life is also happening. I have kids at home. I have a new baby. I'm not sleeping at night. Like, all kinds of stuff are going on. And a friend of mine told me that there was a program going on at one of the shuls. They were showing a video about, something about, like, challenging times or chizuk for challenging times or something. And she's like, Shane, why don't you come? Come with me to the video. I'm like, Rachel, I don't need to hear videos about challenging times. Like, I can make my own video, you know? And she's like, no, come, get out. I'm like, okay, fine. So she schlepped me. Like, I wasn't really in the mood of going. She schlepped me. She's like, it's good for you to get out. Just, I'm taking you. So we go, and it's in the basement of the kollel, and they turn off the lights, and the video is playing, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm here. Like, I don't have time for this. I have no time for this. So what happens? Somebody is speaking on the video. And she says this following story. She said that before a neshama comes down to this world, a neshama sees a video of everything that's going to happen to it in its lifetime. And the neshama is made aware that a neshama's job is to become as perfect as it can, and that everything that happens to it is designed specifically for that neshama, to make that neshama become the best that it could be and become as close to Hashem as possible, and that is the purpose in this world. And when the neshama sees everything that happens to it, the neshama recognizes that, yeah, that makes sense. Oh, that happened, I see it, I get it. Wow, that's amazing. Yes, I agree. I'm going to enter that body, and I'm okay with that. That's going to happen to me. And I sat there, and I froze. I don't remember anything else from that video, because all I remember thinking was, oh, this isn't going to work. Because the whole time, I've been saying, I didn't sign up for this. I didn't sign up for this. It wasn't like somebody gave me a choice and said, okay, ladies, we're looking for a volunteer here. We need the one who's going to sign up to be the wife of a quadriplegic husband. And I'm like, yeah, pick me. I want to have a quadriplegic husband. Pick me, please. And I was like, that line's not going to work anymore, because I didn't sign up for it, but I did. I said yes to this. My neshama saw this before I was born. I signed up for this. And I sat there for the rest of the program in my head and a little bit out loud saying, I signed up for this. Like, in every tone of voice that you could imagine, like, I signed up for this? Oh, I signed up for this. No, I signed up for this? And I was blown away. The rest of the video continued. No idea what else happened. The lights went on. People are leaving. And I'm sitting here there in my chair thinking, I signed up for this. Cute. So I was like, well, if I signed up for this, then I guess I have to do this. And if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. I don't know what right is, but if I signed up for this, then I'm not going to be a failure. I'm not going to fail. I'm a little bit competitive when it comes to that. I'm going to save face. Okay, I signed up for this. And that really, really changed how I looked at things. Because instead of it being something that happened to me, it became something that I was a part of. It became my decision. I owned it. And in fact, I remember we had an incident of many, but one particular incident where I had with the case manager who was supposed to be helping me do things because everyone said, Shando, get help, you can't do it on your own, you need help. So I tried to get help, and the help was sometimes worse than no help at all. And I had this one lady who was supposed to help me with something, and she wasn't coming through. And I remember one time I lost my patience with her, and I said to her, I don't understand. You're in the healthcare profession. You signed up for this. I signed up for this. Did you sign up for this? I don't think she knew what I was talking about. But I was like, I signed up for this. You're in the healthcare profession. You're supposed to be doing this. If you signed up for this, you have to help me. She did. But that's another whole story. So it really, really changed how I looked at the situation. Another thing that changed me was, you know, again, this is, well, didn't just happen like the day after the next. You know, this is all processing and all other things happening and at different points. So like a couple of more years down the line, I was still teaching. I teach junior high and adults. And we were learning Parshas Vayeschana. We're learning where Moshe Rabbeinu davens to go into Eretz Yisrael over 500 times. And he's davening again and again. And think about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, who went up to Har Sinai 3 times, 40 days each, you know, saw the back of Hashem, spoke to Hashem like you know, panim el panim, like he would speak to your friend, you know, he would, you know, able to tell, but also, but 1 second, I'll ask Hashem, and Hashem answered him, who knew, who gave the Torah, who gave the mitzvot, and who knew the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, who understand the importance of Eretz Yisrael, who is desperate to go into Eretz Yisrael to be able to be part of that Kedusha, to be able to be part of that Haftacha that Hashem promised to the Avos, you know, since Avram and on. And he knew the Kedusha, and he knew about all the mitzvot that once someone is in there, to know all the mitzvot that they could keep, and the kesher that he'd have, and the Kedusha, and the Ruchnius. And he's like, Hashem, I want to be a part of that. And then Rashi tells us that Hashem says to Moshe, Rav Tov Hatzafun Lecha, something better is hidden for you. I have something better for you. Moshe Rabbeinu, you think you want to go into Eretz Yisrael. You have all the right reasons of why you want to go. But no, it's not for you. I have something better for you. That's not your role now. That's not what you need right now. And I sat there in my chair, and I was translating it again in my head, and I said, Rav Tov Hatzafun Lecha, I have something better for you. I have something better for you. And this was Moshe. And he thought he knew what he wanted. And he thought that he knew what was right. I know what I thought I wanted my life to look like. It's not looking like that at all. But Rav Tov Hatzafun Lecha, Hashem says, you thought you knew what you wanted. You went to Ottawa to make a Kiddush Hashem. And that's why you went. You wanted to be an Eved Hashem. You wanted to serve Hashem and make a Kiddush Hashem. And that's the whole reason you went. And after the accident, the hours and hours and the tears we cried, asking ourselves, how are we supposed to be a Kiddush Hashem now? What are we supposed to do now? When we called our Rebbeim and our Rebbeim are giving chizuk, and we said, but what now, Rebbe, what? What do we do now? My husband always said, I don't ask Hashem why, I ask Hashem what. What does Hashem want from me now? Where do I go from here? I thought that being an Eved Hashem and serving Hashem means walking on my 2 feet, going into a classroom and having my students over, and I can't do that now. What does being an Eved Hashem mean now? We didn't know. What does it mean to be Eved? Like, we had something, we had a picture in our mind, and Hashem clearly said, the picture's changed. That's not what it is anymore. I have something better for you. So, like, I was thinking about that, and, like, I just sat there in my seat, and I wrote it on a piece of paper, and I went to my fridge, And I stuck it on my fridge, and then I went to call my sister and my friend and my other sister. I'm like, you have no idea what I just learned. You have no idea. And what I did for everybody here tonight, I have it on a magnet. I'll give it out to you after. Rab Tov Hatzafun Lecha. I have something better for you. We think we know what we want. We think what we know what we need. We think we know what our role is in our tachlis, and we don't always know. We have all the best intentions in the world, but we don't always know what the right thing is. And that's what we had to do. We had to redefine ourselves. How do you redefine normal to abnormal? Like, there was nothing normal about our situation. Nothing. And the rehab center would tell us, you need to meet people. You need to get together and go to a peer support system. I said, great. Find me a rabbi with 9 kids that's quadriplegic, and I'm happy to talk to them. But Baruch Hashem, there aren't any. And one of the reasons there aren't any is because my husband's injury was so high that they said, like, his spinal cord injury was C4, C5. And they said, usually people with that injury are higher. Their neck snaps. He wouldn't have survived. He should not have survived the accident. A drop lower, C5, C6, they already have more use of their hands. And more typical quadriplegics are 5-6. And it's a whole other ballgame, because with them, their diaphragm is not affected. So they have no breathing issues. My husband had breathing issues, and he was prone to pneumonias. And ultimately, that's what took his life. So it was, you know, from the breathing and the scarring and all the pneumonias that he had. So those are two things that really, really stuck with me. Another thing that I learned from my husband, that he would say it, you know, when he spoke. And in terms of redefining ourselves, it took a while to redefine. These things don't happen overnight. He was a quadriplegic for about 7 years before he was there, 6.5, 7 years. And over the course of that time, he did find a role. We did find a way for him to make a Kiddush Hashem and for him to be an Oved Hashem. He wasn't able